Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to welcome John DeGatta, who is the anthologist, the editor and introducer of A Monument. It's a three-volume set, the most recent volume of which has just appeared. The three volumes are called A New History of the Essay. It's from Grey Wolf. The newest volume is The Making of the American Essay. And I have to confess to a real vested interest in these books. Years ago, nearly 20, I got a book from John DeGatta in the mail. It was a book of his own essays called Halls of Fame. I was very enthusiastic about it, but as far as I'm concerned, it might have come from another planet. So I called him up and I said, "You seem to be coming at essays from a perspective that I don't know at all. Can you help me? To me, I'm discovering something brand new, and I have the feeling you have a context for it that has to do with the history of the essay." I think John did one of the things that he is best known for. He assembled a package. He sent it through the mail to me. It was a big, big package in which were Xeroxed essays of every sort. There were essays about what a mother's voice sounded like when her son was off to war. And this was an old essay. Who wrote it?
Plutarch in the second century in Greece.
Yes. To write an essay that sounded as if it were written during the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. Second century Greece. I had thousands of pages, more than I could read in a sitting, and I regarded it as a kind of treasure chest. Every time I had a spare moment, I'd be reading another essay that came from John's box, until gradually, one by one, many of these essays, and many more, made their appearance in The New History of the Essay. How did this all start, John?
It started when I was in school. It started when I was simultaneously studying poetry and nonfiction as a graduate student at the University of Iowa, and simultaneously completely in love with my poetry classes, because we had a sense, all of us, while we were there, that there was a giant cannon hanging over our heads that was as menacing as it was inspiring. We had a poetry instructor who told us that, you know, we were a part of a 4,000-year-old tradition, and we had to keep it alive. And so it was a deep, deep sense that we were part of a heritage, that we were inheriting something, and it was our responsibility to pass it on. And simultaneously, I was in nonfiction classes. And at the University of Iowa at that time, which was the end of the 90s, nonfiction was new to not only Iowa, but to the academy. In fact, my graduating class was the first class to receive MFAs in nonfiction. And so when we were in class, we didn't have a sense of that canon. I often felt when we were in class that I had walked into an organizational meeting for a new political party. Our conversations were about who we were and what we stood for and what we should call ourselves, but really not at all, you know, where we came from and what we were inheriting and what our duties to the past or to the future were. And it also didn't help that I was writing essays that that didn't really fit in. They weren't what were being published in America at the time. And I guess they didn't look like anything that I was being assigned to read. So I just went in search for some kinship, for lack of a less cheesy way of putting it. I went in search for the heritage that I loved in poetry but was missing in nonfiction.
I think that one of the best things we could do is to start out with the very first piece in the book. It's a one-pager. It's a prologue. Under other circumstances, it could be seen as a creation myth. Mm-hmm. It's anonymous. Where does it come from?
It comes from the Cato Indian tribe, which is in Northern California, in the Pacific Coast range of mountains. And that's all I know about the group. The date is roughly 1000 CE or 1000 AD. It was translated in about the 20s. But of course, who knows how long it had existed as an oral tradition in the tribe.
Well, listen to this. It's fantastic. It'll give you an idea of the difference between what was being published as essays back then and what John wanted to find in essays, the possibilities that could be found once you open the door. This is Creation. It's the prologue to John DeGatta's anthology, The Making of the American Essay.
Water went, they say. Land was not, they say. Water only, then. Mountains were not, they say. Stones were not, they say. Fish were not, they say. Deer were not, they say. Grizzlies were not, they say. Panthers were not, they say. Wolves were not, they say. People were washed away, they say. Grizzlies were washed away, they say. Panthers were washed away, they say. Deer were washed away, they say. Coyotes were not then, they say. Ravens were not, they say. Herons were not, they say. Woodpeckers were not, they say. Then wrens were not, they say. Then hummingbirds were not, they say. Then otters were not, they say. Then jackrabbits, gray squirrels were not, they say. Then long-eared mice were not, they say. Then wind was not, they say. Then snow was not, they say. Then rain was not, they say. Then it didn't thunder, they say. Then trees were not when it didn't thunder, they say. It didn't lighten, they say. Then clouds were not, they say. Fog was not, they say. It didn't appear, they say. Stars were not, they say. It was very dark.
I guess the first thing you would have to say on encountering this is how beautiful it is.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. How its repetitions are simple observations about a world covered by a flood and then by fog, and then things disappear, mm-hmm. and they disappear into this prose, mm-hmm. which is amazing, mm-hmm. and is as crazily modern as anything by Gertrude Stein.
Yeah.
Ezra Pound says make it new, yeah. and you use it as an epigraph, mm-hmm. but really new is what's very old. Now, what do you mean by a made thing, John DeGatta? Because the idea seems central to your book, The Making of the American Essay.
Well, in terms of this creation myth, I think what's interesting about it and what makes it new and yet from the past is that it's an example of a really old trope, a flood story, a creation story, being made technically new and not by the translator. You can feel the uniqueness in this story in that it's working both forwards and backwards. It's both a creation story and a story of destruction. We end up in darkness, but it's hard to tell whether that darkness is the beginning of the world or what happens after the world is destroyed. What's also amazing about it is that technically it's kind of astonishing in that what it's really trying to help us get our heads around is the nothingness of that darkness, the nothingness of the beforeness of creation or the afterness of creation.
John, did you feel part of a new creation in focusing on the essay and its history?
I still feel that we're kind of in the Wild West when it comes to essays, that at least for me, because I didn't feel like I had that heritage in nonfiction that I felt in poetry. For me, at least, I felt like I was creating something for myself. If anything, these are very personal documents because they're these three anthologies, because they're the story of me trying to figure out where I think I come from.
Each of the essays is preceded by a note. Mm-hmm. A note written by John DeGatta. He tells me many things I didn't know. Now, I have to begin with a confession. Every time I've been in an American literature class that began with the Puritans, my soul would sink. I was afraid of them. I didn't want to read them. I often found them dull. Yes, I was told there's a point where they kill a whole field of lambs because one of them is suspected of sexual congress with a human being. But for the most part, it's rather dull stuff, so I thought. But then John DeGatta provides me with a selection of Anne Bradstreet, which is called For My Dear Son Simon Bradstreet, and he lets me know that no one in all the Americas wrote as much as Anne Bradstreet between her poetry and her journals. Is this in fact true?
As far as I know, we fact-checked this twice. We fact-checked all of these books twice. Apparently, it's actually a more startling statistic than that. No female writer, no male writer in either the New World or the Old World, in either the New English-speaking world or the Old English-speaking world, wrote more than Anne Bradstreet, if we include her letters, her journals, her poems, these notes to her children, like For My Dear Son Simon Bradstreet. It was thought she had essentially read everything that was available to someone in the English language at the time. She was, in fact, as necessary to start a new world as the pitchforks and the gallons of ale and the horses and pigs that they brought over.
That's beautiful. Did you just think that up?
Well,
that's so well said.
I think it's what people say about her.
And followed by Jonathan Edwards's great Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, one of the classic invocations of heavenly fury, followed by Washington Irving's satirical History of New York, followed by Emerson's unsatirical speculations about the nature of nature, which is the nature of humans and the nature of God. And as I make my way through this anthology, Henry Thoreau's essay on walking, a section from Moby Dick that takes the form of a famous dark essay called The Whiteness of the Whale, you start to say, well, everything I would want to have in an anthology of America is here. Mm-hmm. So how personal is it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why can't it be personal? It's personal in... Damn, that's a tough question. It's personal in that I'm bringing together texts, perhaps in this anthology more so than the two preceding it, that are a little more famous, that we did grow up with. But I'm bringing them together and asking them to rub shoulders in ways that maybe they aren't used to. So, you know...
They're different because the context is different.
Yeah, we're looking at them all through a new frame. I was never... I had read, like you, Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, but never in an essay class. And
yes, in sermon class.
Right. And, you know, certainly The Whiteness of the Whale from Moby Dick, I never encountered in an essay class. The point is to see what happens when we bring together texts that we're used to reading as essays and not used to reading as essays, and see what happens. You know, what happens to Moby Dick when it's framed in such an essay-heavy context? Do we read it differently? I don't mean to suggest that do we change our minds and now think that Moby Dick is an essay. Instead, I'm wondering whether we can notice something in it that we would call essayistic. And if we can, one, what does that mean about Moby Dick? But more importantly, what does it mean about the essay?
Well, I think it's also that Whitman had an idea about America. America, he says, contains multitudes. Mm-hmm. Well, Moby Dick contains multitudes, multitudes of prose forms. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it contains poems. Sometimes it contains seductive, you know, notes on a seduction that brings a young white sailor into the same bed as a completely tattooed native, mm-hmm. Queequeg. Mm-hmm. And they share a night together, and instead of waking up with any sense of difficulty, they wake up feeling like bridegrooms. Mm-hmm. Astounding things Moby Dick contains. Mm-hmm. Astounding things, I would like to say, that the making of the American essay by my guest, John DeGatta, contains. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John DeGatta about his latest book, The Making of the American Essay, the last of a fantastic trilogy highlighting the best examples of the form and going beyond the form, breaking the form, so that if we were to look at the last pages, we would look at things that we think we'd be familiar with in an anthology of essays. There's Norman Mailer's 10,000 words a minute. There's James Baldwin's accounting of the fight between Patterson and Liston. There's Tom Wolfe's candy-colored tangerine flake streamlined baby, and there's Gay Talese's terrific Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. Four things that we should all feel comfortable with, followed by William H. Gass's In the Heart of the Country, one of the most famous short stories that the country produced during the century in which it was written, followed by an N. Scott Momaday piece, The Way to Rainy Mountain, followed, I'm thrilled, by a great hunk of Joe Brainard's I Remember, a Donald Barthelme piece called Sentence, a Susan Steinberg story called Signified, the great and rediscovered Renata Adler's Brownstone, Kathy Acker, Humility, which is a form of manifesto, in a sense, and an epilogue with Harriet Mullen, a wonderful, unusual black poet. Let's hear it, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Elliptical. They just can't seem to. They should try harder to. They ought to be more. We all wish they weren't so. They never. They always. Sometimes they. Once in a while they. However, it is obvious that they. Their overall tendency has been. The consequences of which have been. They don't appear to understand that. If only they would make an effort to. But we know how difficult it is for them to. Many of them remain unaware of. Some who should know better simply refuse to. Of course, their perspective has been limited by. On the other hand, they obviously feel entitled to. Certainly we can't forget that they. Nor can it be denied that they. We know that this has had an enormous impact on their. Nevertheless, their behavior strikes us as. Our interactions, unfortunately, have been.
That's by Harriet Mullen. It's called Elliptical. It serves as an epilogue, and it's clearly meant to balance the prologue, which you've heard. And it's there to make us aware that whereas in the first piece, the world is disappearing, in the second piece, everything is being covered by explanatory language which refuses to tell us what it's accounting for. Why or how is the essay like or unlike poetry? And does it matter?
I think poems and essays are more closely related than any other forms of literature. They're both associative. That's what makes them related. They both follow the folds of a mind as it's considering something, a new idea, an emotion, a memory. The essay for me is essentially a literary mode that tracks the evolution of a mind as it's considering something. And
say it one more time.
An essay for me essentially is a literary mode that tracks the evolution of the human mind as it considers something.
What I'm curious about is your definition can account for a great deal of the writing that I like and love.
Right.
Does it account for Gay Talese's Frank Sinatra Has a Cold?
That's a good question. Well, I would backtrack and say I think it accounts for almost everything in that I think poems fit in that definition and novels fit in that definition. Whether a work of reportage fits into that definition, Talese's essay was groundbreaking when it came out.
It's terrific.
It was an entirely new way of writing a profile without interacting with one subject. It was completely observed and overheard and yet wildly intimate, incredibly intimate. And so I think the fact that he barely interacted with his subjects, we could say that despite how smoothly he he handles the problem of not really being able to interact with Sinatra. You can feel him, you can feel the mechanism of his mind in that essay, trying to build his case, build his argument, and, you know, move over the folds of his thinking about who this person is.
I'm talking to John DeGatta. John, how many years of your life did this whole three-volume history, new history of the essay take?
I started it in grad school about 1996, 1997, so almost 20 years, 18 years, 19 years.
I would say that of the 20-some years I've been doing my show, there are a few books that I'm certain will be read well beyond the show's duration. And it's been one of the real pleasures of knowing you and having you on the show and being invited occasionally to even write comments on the back of these books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm honored to be associated with them. I think these are books that really were worth the effort. And I mean all 17 to 20 years of it. And it's a real pleasure to read in them because your inter-essays, your introductions and such, are as odd as your sense of what an essay is. Finding out who John DeGatta is and how he thinks is one of the pleasures of reading his new history of the essay and its most recent volume, The Making of the American Essay. All three volumes are published by Grey Wolf. I think it's something that if the shelves in your library don't breathe a sigh of satisfaction when you place these three volumes on them, I'd be very surprised, and I'd say you're not listening carefully enough to your shelves. We're talking about The Making of the American Essay with my guest, its editor, John DeGatta. Thank you very much for joining me, John.
You're welcome. Thank you again, Michael, for inviting me and for being a champion before anyone else was of the weird essay.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Making of the American Essay, well, a sliver, on kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Today, Alan Howard has acted as co-producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Today, Philip Richards has acted as our technical director. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when John Keane's our guest.